as part of a government-led nationwide campaign dubbed Tricolor in Every Home. In Srinagar's Sher-e Kashmir Stadium, Kashmir's Lieutenant Governor Manoj Sinha unfurled the Indian tricolor in the presence of government officials.
Anudana hopes and dreams is here. Since August 2019, the Union Territory of Jammu and Kashmir is scripting history and is recording unprecedented performance in every sector.
The administration in Kashmir took stringent security measures to ensure a smooth flag hoisting ceremony. Barbed wires were stretched across roads, guarded by security forces to avoid the breach of security or any militant attack. Shops and business establishments were closed and traffic remained largely suspended. But prominent politicians in Kashmir say holding such celebrations in Kashmir only hurts the sentiments of the people of Kashmir and is just rubbing salt in the wounds after what they call India's illegal move of scrapping Kashmir's special status on August 5, 2019.
Post-abrogation of Article 370, New Delhi has not been fair to the people of Kashmir. It was a death of democracy. People's wishes and aspirations were not considered. The unfurling of the tricolor in the city center by a handful of people amid tough security is not what we call normality. If it was normal, people would have participated in large numbers, and this is what the government of India needs to address.
He added, in the absence of political process, people of Kashmir seem to have lost all rights and have been silenced. The decisions are taken without taking people on board.
On August 5, 2019, New Delhi abrogated Kashmir's special status and divided the region into two parts, calling it integrating the region with the rest of India. Experts say if India wants to win over the hearts of Kashmiri people, instead of imposing decisions, India must start addressing the concerns of people. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Meet Rira, the latest crossover car produced by Iran's giant automaker, Iran Khodro. The vehicle was unveiled at Iran Khodro's factory west of Tehran. The Iranian automaker says this is the first crossover ever built in Iran, which can compete with international rivals. Iranian automakers, namely Iran Khodro and Saipa, have picked up the slack after Francis Peugeot and Renault, along with other international automotive companies, exited Iran in 2018, in the wake of U.S. sanctions on Tehran that created a supply crunch, pushing car prices to unprecedented highs. The crisis forced Iranian companies to produce Iranian-made vehicles. While admitting the adverse effects of U.S. sanctions, Iran Khodro Managing Director Mehdi Khatibi said the measures have had their silver lining.
We don't agree with sanctions. We favor free international trade. However, sanctions helped us become an automaker. And today I should tell you that Iran Khodro is a respectable and reliable car producer in the world.
Iranian-made cars already roll on the streets of countries such as Iraq, Syria, Azerbaijan and Senegal. However, Iran Khodro has higher ambitions, planning to export 100,000 cars each year.
In Turkmenistan, we have exported our buses. Our new market will be North Africa, especially Tunisia, where we have already presented our Rona model. We will also resume exporting to Venezuela and Armenia. And all this have come despite U.S. sanctions.
Launched in 1966, Iran Khodro Industrial Group, or shortly IKCO, started by producing the first Iranian-made car, Paycon, based on Britain's Hillman Hunter in the 1960s. Paycon was discontinued in 2005. Some of the old-fashioned cars, such as Peugeot 206, are still rolling off the production lines of Iran Khodro. However, the Iranian carmaker says it will soon stop producing them. It plans to focus on manufacturing luxury cars such as Rira, which it regards as a bridge toward a foothold in the global market.
With all the ups and downs, Iran Khodro has come a long way from copying foreign designs to manufacturing its own cars. However, the Iranian automaker says it's not complacent with where it stands and will continue its journey toward making cars on par with international brands. Yusuf Jalalip, Tehran.
Austria is famous for its stunning architecture and artistic legacy, boasting to be the home of the great German composers, including Mozart and Beethoven. Sadly, however, Austria has built up another reputation in recent years, that of growing intolerance towards its Muslim minority. According to data released in June 2022, over 1,000 Islamophobic incidents were reported the previous year, a shocking increase which has grown year upon year.
Research into anti-Muslim hate crimes in Austria have found that the overwhelming majority of the incidents which take place has been men targeting women, with a staggering 69% of victims being female, many of whom wear the hijab. However, it's not just on the street level where the targeted harassment of Muslims is taking place.
The sharp spike of 2021 was allegedly assisted by the controversial state-implemented Islam map, introduced by authorities to highlight the location of all mosques across Austria. Critics believe it aided in the spread of hate crimes. Press TV sat down with Iman Shaker, who's experienced firsthand what it's like to be a target of hate after she was almost physically assaulted for wearing a hijab.
I don't think you can name a single visibly Muslim person in this country that hasn't been verbally attacked or even physically. And I try to not give a lot of attention to the individual attacks I face, because that would just be...
Although it was hard to relive the experience, Iman doesn't believe in playing the victim, instead focusing on the root cause.
Focusing on a single perpetrator and focusing my anger towards him would be very weakening, in my opinion, because in the end he has fallen victim to the narrative that the state has given him about us being a threat.
In November 2020, Austrian authorities launched Operation Luxor, which saw homes and offices of Muslim charities and activists raided as part of a so-called war on political Islam. But critics claim its only achievement is dehumanizing Muslims and fueling growing public fear towards Islam. An increase in fear almost certainly leads to more hate. Robert Carter, Vienna.
Thousands of South Korean unionists and their progressive supporters rallied in downtown Seoul to protest against joint U.S.-South Korea war games planned for later this month. The drills will be the largest in years and follow the May election of President Yoon Suk-yeol, who's promised to take a hard line with North Korea. Union leaders worry about risks.
The threat of nuclear war is growing on the Korean Peninsula. Conservative forces of Yoon Suk-yeol in South Korea and those in the U.S. are frantically conducting aggressive war drills in the sky, the land and the sea, and are about to start large-scale joint military exercises aimed at the invasion of North Korea. We must stamp out this behavior of anti-reunification forces.
While many South Koreans, especially supporters of President Yoon on the right, favor close ties with the U.S., large numbers also argue the U.S. military and the country's alliance with Washington prevent the improvement of ties with North Korea and generate tension.
We not only oppose the war exercises, but we want the U.S. forces, Korea, which is actually controlling and interfering with the Korean Peninsula, to leave this land. We believe that only then will the 80 million Koreans from both North and South be able to live peacefully.
The drills will reportedly involve a U.S. aircraft carrier strike group with extensive field training to include amphibious maneuvers. South Korea has also been training alongside U.S. forces with recently acquired American F-35 Joint Strike Fighters. In an effort to strengthen the U.S.-South Korea alliance, military officials from Seoul and Washington will meet to discuss the deployment of U.S. strategic assets and extended deterrence, which refers to the deployment of U.S. nuclear weapons in the defense of South Korea. Frank Smith, Seoul.
This is IRIB English Radio. website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite, words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee, and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Thank you.
The study has revealed that the U.S. has waged 400 wars since its founding, a quarter of them in West Asia and in Africa. What does that say about the founding fathers of the U.S. to present-day leaders? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why the U.S. has what appears to be war as a doctrine, why it has focused on Africa and West Asia to wage these wars, and why it has not won any wars recently, despite waging so many of them. Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, we had editor at Veterans Today, Kevin Barrett, who joins us from Madison. We also have journalist and author Daniel Lazar joining us from New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Daniel Lazar, I'll start with you. The name of the study, Introducing the Military Intervention Project, a new data set on U.S. military interventions. Which sounds with a lot of bells and whistles there. Okay. The U.S. undertook almost 400 military interventions from its founding in 1776 to 2019. It sounds like a lot. The research we did supports the numbers. Then the question comes about, why is the U.S. relying on military interventions in such a way, or executing it, I should say, in such a way?
Well, that's about one intervention every 8 months, when you consider the U.S. has been around for about 250 years or so. The U.S. is a state. It's very aggressive. It's violent, like all states are violent. But this violence has certainly exploded since World War II. When the U.S. led the step forth and emerged as the leader of the global crusade against communism. And then it took another leap upwards in 1991, when the Soviet bloc collapsed, the U.S. was the last superpower left standing. So the U.S. Did its best to assert its global hegemony across the world. And that meant a dramatic increase in military conflicts. And then there was yet another increase after 9/11, when the U.S., stepped up its military warfare, and especially with regard to the Middle East, started pouring arms into the region, fostering war, invading it itself, of course, and essentially bringing about chaos from one end of the region to the other.
Let's go to what you pointed out there, Daniel Lazar, and I'll ask you, Kevin Barrett, about back in 1991 when the Soviet Union collapsed, the U.S. was left to be the dominant military power. Why then was there an increase in the military interventions? Why wasn't there a decrease? What led the U.S. towards down that path?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I remember back then that there was a widespread feeling that Americans and the world would be getting a peace dividend. We look forward to a big reduction in government expenditures, big reduction in taxes, and an enhanced civilian economy. And somehow that didn't happen. And I think that the people who profit from these wars, who became part of the national security complex, which is really an imperial kind of bureaucratic and corporate and criminal overlapping set of worlds, that these people profit mightily from war. And they wanted to make sure that those wars continued. So they began pretty half-heartedly in the 1990s with interventions in Eastern Europe and things like that, continuing to rain death on Iraq by killing Iraqi children through sanctions, things like that. But I think they recognized that that wasn't sustainable because of the general tenor of public opinion in the U.S., which has always followed George Washington's dictate that the U.S. should never be involved in foreign quarrels. And indeed, the founding fathers believe there should only be a military that gets called up in the event of the U.S. being attacked and invaded externally, as happened in the War of 1812. Of course, that set of beliefs of the public has never really matched reality very well. But I think they had to change that. And so that's why we got the September 11th, 2001 New Pearl Harbor. That was a false flag event that was modeled after the original Pearl Harbor, which had been the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor that was actually orchestrated by an eight-point plan put together by the Roosevelt Brain Trust under supervision of British intelligence. And that the Pearl Harbor scam was used to turn around 80% plus U.S. public opinion against entry into World War II. And suddenly overnight, the entire American public, with a very, very few exceptions, welcomed U.S. Involvement in World War II. And then that mentality continued after the war and allowed for this vastly increased level of militarism. So they did the same thing in 2001. They created a new Pearl Harbor, which indeed the very defense intellectuals who orchestrated this had actually openly yearned for in a September 2000 document called Rebuilding America's Defenses. They basically called for a new Pearl Harbor. And so then they got it when their operatives blew up the World Trade Center with explosives and attacked the Pentagon, blamed it on Muslims, which was completely false. Those 19 guys they blamed were not even on the planes. At least there's no evidence that they were. So that event, that great deception, was used to condition the American public, just as Pearl Harbor conditioned them to believe that they had to go out and try to rule the world in order to not be vulnerable to a surprise attack. The same mentality reigned after September 11th, and Americans became completely irrational, gave up their desire for a peace dividend, gave up whatever remnants of belief in George Washington's foreign policy they had. And so the imperial warmongers were free to double their military budget, to increase their biological warfare budget by 10,000% in the wake of the false flag anthrax attack by the U.S. biodefense sector on the U.S. Congress, and do everything that they've done since then, which is essentially turn the U.S. into the most criminal militaristic dictatorship that's ever existed.
Well, I'd like to find out how we got to that point. And Daniel Lazar, it's hard to really try to follow the way that this transpired. But I'm going to go along the lines of the number of U.S. military bases, which is roughly around 800. Where did this number and how did this number really come about? I mean, you know, you go through year by year and there's a think tank of some kind or it's deep inside the Pentagon. Let's have a U.S. base here. Let's have one over there. How does it get to be to the point where there's so many of them and for the U.S. to have the biggest military spending? Or is not defense, military spending of around roughly $800 billion. How did the U.S. get to that point?
Well, let me just begin by saying that Kevin Barrett is a friend of mine. I like him very much, but I disagree with him profoundly about Pearl Harbor or 9/11. Pearl Harbor was an attack by the Japanese, and 9/11 was truly an attack by Al-Qaeda's origins are tied up with the U.S. Sponsored war in Afghanistan, but that attack was quite real. It was not carried out by American operatives of any sort. And as for why there are
evidence against those innocent 19 men,
and as why there are 800 bases around the world. Well, after 1991, the U.S. became the global hegemon, and it felt it was its responsibility to patrol the entire globe. And that meant putting into operation a very complicated structure of military domination. And that involved 800 bases or so, give or take 50, around the globe. And the U.S. also set out to outspend the rest of the world. I mean, I think U.S. spending is now it's greater than that of the next 10 nations combined. So the U.S. turned itself into a global military colossus whose purpose is to control the globe, control the earth in a way that is conducive to America's profits, its economic growth, its attempt to further its superpower status,
etc. Let me jump in when you say that, because when you say the U.S. Has all these military bases, which I pose to you as a question, you also said that the U.S. is out to control the world. What right does it give the U.S. through its military to then feel through that it can control the world? I mean, is that the type of thinking? I'm just trying to make sure I'm clear on this.
It gives it no right, of course, no right at all, of course. You're absolutely correct. It's an excellent question. The U.S. has no moral right. It has no legal right under international law. You're correct, but it's a case of might makes right. The U.S. has this huge military structure, which the rest of the world can't say no to, and therefore it uses it to enforce its will around the globe. Now, the problem today is that a growing number of countries are saying no, such as Russia, Iran, and China. So therefore, that has the U.S. deeply upset and is leading to ever more aggressive actions by the imperial center.
So if might is right, Kevin Barrett, doesn't that go hand in hand with U.S. foreign policy to make these countries where U.S. has military bases, as an example, that, okay, this is our line, and you're either with us or you're with them in a sense, but I'm sorry, that's a quote from somebody else. So is that how it goes? Parallel with the U.S. Military bases and defense spending, that the countries need to follow the U.S. foreign policy?
Well, of course, the U.S. has used these military bases and other forms of power to push around the governments of other countries in all sorts of different ways. And one of the ways that we haven't heard much about in the Western media is the history of U.S. nuclear threats against other nations. I have a book somewhere on my bookshelves documenting, I forget precisely how many dozens of such direct threats to use nuclear weapons against other nations. And so this is a kind of bullying and intimidation set tactic. It's a little bit like the mafia with its threats. It's obviously corrupt, and it is about various forms of profiteering. And those forms can be obvious, as is the case of the way that the U.S. military is used to keep the billionaire oligarch elite of the West in a position to continue robbing the world blind and robbing their own societies blind as well. We don't tolerate governments that are strong enough to protect their own citizens, much less anybody else, against the depredations of our neoliberal oligarchs. So that part is obvious. There are also all sorts of other ways that people within and around the so-called military-industrial complex profit from this empire. And one of the biggest and least known by consumers of mainstream media is drug smuggling. That is, that it's not that widely known, unfortunately, that since the late 1940s, the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency has been by far the world's biggest illegal drug smuggler. And I highly recommend the book on Operation Gladio by, I forget, the former Fox News correspondent of all people who wrote it, that documents how the CIA saw that Chiang Kai-shek had managed to finance his war operations using illegal narcotics money, and that whoever did this was going to have a big edge up in ruling the world. And so the CIA got into that game, and they ended up using the Vatican Bank as their biggest single money laundry. I think a lot of Catholics would be shocked to know this. So there's a lot of criminal profiteering that goes on. It's no coincidence that Vietnam happened right there in the Golden Triangle, where the U.S. was shipping back vast amounts of heroin in the coffins of dead soldiers. The film Air America documents this. And then it's no coincidence that we went into Afghanistan at a time when the Taliban had shut down the heroin industry. And the first thing that the U.S. forces did was free the drug lords and set them to work. And within 2 years, record profits, record crops were being generated. So there are all sorts of these corrupt ways of profiteering that justify the imperial depredations of the empire. And that's the, I think these are the kinds of real reasons why the U.S. is doing this, not any kind of belief in the superiority of the American system or the need for a rules-based international order and all this nonsense. They're just a bunch of corrupt criminal types who are making money from it, and they want to continue making money.
Okay, since you talked about profits and money, arms sales for the U.S., it has been a top supplier based on CPRI to West Asia or Middle East, where the U.S. arms export, Daniel Lazar, increased from 32% to 37% over the last 5 years. This being a report from the year 2019, I should mention, with imports by Middle East and North Africa growing by 25%. Well, guess what? The study that we talked about, the topic of this program, reveals that the U.S. has waged these wars, a quarter of them in West Asia and in Africa. Is this a coincidence? And why then is West Asia and Africa the focus?
First, it's not a coincidence. The U.S. pours arms into these regions in order to destabilize them and thereby control them all the more effectively. But the reason is resources. In the case of the Middle East, it's oil. I mean, oil is what capitalism has run on for the last century. It is absolutely crucial to industrial capitalism as it is now constructed. And so therefore, you know, the Middle East has become the great prize. The U.S. has poured, you know, incredible resources, literally trillions of dollars, into militarizing Middle East. And what are the consequences? The consequences of the region has been torn by one major war after the other. Hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions, have been killed. Entire countries have been laid waste, such as Syria and Lebanon and Yemen. Others like Iraq have been destroyed. Iran has been under an economic siege since the 1980s. And meanwhile, the U.S. is arming to the teeth Saudi Arabia, perhaps the most repressive single government on the face of the earth. And the U.S. does this all in the name of democracy. I mean, it's a complete joke. But the effect of all this is to cause living conditions to plummet in these regions.
Well, then let me ask you this, Kevin Barrett. If the U.S. was not to be involved in these militaristic approaches that it has had, i.e. wars, what kind of world would we be living in now? Because right now, Afghanistan is a mess. Iran is being threatened right and left with either through Israel, which is a U.S. ally, not to mention other countries in West Asia, which are either unstable or teetering on it, such as Syria. We're looking at the U.S., Ukraine, Russia-Ukraine conflict, but the U.S. obviously is in there somewhere. And then you have China, and we're seeing what's happening there. But what if the U.S. wasn't involved at all? What kind of world would we be living in now?
Well, there are a lot of indications that it would be much more peaceful and prosperous, certainly in West Asia. If we look at what the U.S. has done to whom and why, what we see over and over is the same pattern, that when a country starts becoming reasonably prosperous because its leadership is putting the interests of its own people first, that's when the U.S. attacks. That's what we did to Saddam Hussein in Iraq. For all of his many faults and crimes, Saddam Hussein had basically eliminated corruption from that country, except within his own family, of course, and had built the living standards, the infrastructure, and the educational levels up to near first world levels. And that's why Iraq had to be destroyed. And likewise with Gaddafi in Libya, who had brought Libya into the 21st century as by far the most prosperous country in Africa. And that's why Libya had to be destroyed as well. Iran has been a surprising success economically, despite the incredible sanctions and the opposition of so much of the world ever since the 1979 revolution. Still, Iran has done reasonably well, and that's why Iran is still facing so much hostility. And then if we look at just what happened in Pakistan, Imran Khan had actually presided over an incredibly successful couple of years where the economic growth shot up to 6-7%. Because Imran Khan was following policies that would benefit the Pakistani people by trading with partners like China that are interested in trade rather than just depredation. And so the U.S. overthrew Imran Khan's government, as it always overthrows and targets governments that put the best interests of their own people first. So if we didn't have this U.S. empire destroying countries and overthrowing governments that are, in fact, working on behalf of their people, we would probably have a much more peaceful and prosperous planet. All of that money that's being wasted in death and destruction would be saved, and the world would be much better off.
Well, this is what the U.S. has said, Daniel Azar, and I'm going to read off a particular organization that I'm going to ask you who you think has released this, where it says, as a title, the U.S. strategy to prevent conflict and to promote stability, priority countries and region. The U.S. government is moving forward in the spirit of partnership with countries and a regional grouping of countries to implement the 10-year U.S. strategy to prevent conflict and to promote stability. Can you guess what organization has actually stated that?
I would suggest the National Security Council.
USAID.
USAID.
Exactly.
Okay,
from the American classic people. So they're using this organization, and this is their line, but we know that USAID has been involved in regime change operations in Cuba, in Russia, and perhaps elsewhere. Cuba and Russia distinctly stand out.
Yes. But this is the way America works. I mean, America sees itself as the font of justice and rightness. Everything America does is by definition right. Even when America makes mistakes, it's because it's too good. It's trying too hard to make the world a better place. So occasionally it oversteps. But in general, the fundamental assumption across the entire political spectrum, across the entire corporate press, is that America is good, it is just, it is correct. It is a country that is trying its best to make the world a better place. And so therefore, yes, when it wages war, it's really trying to wage peace. And it's only because other countries oppose its peacemaking efforts that war results. I mean, it's completely narcissistic reasoning, but that is how America works. That is the basic mental function of U.S. society in general.
All right. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. I'm going to thank our guests. Thank you for your input there, Daniel Azar, journalist and author from New York. Kevin Barrett, thank you so much, editor at Veterans Today, who spoke to us from Madison. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. From Ikaba Tabway and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful, Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. As you know, we have taken up explanation of Surah Hadid, which is number 57, in the serial order of compilation of the Noble Quran, and mentions the heavy metallic element called hadith or iron as being sent down by God to endow the earth itself with mighty force and provide humanity with the many benefits of its structural strength, as well as all the great tests of faith that arise from this. The surah presents several divine attributes, then proceeds with the grandeur of the Noble Quran, the state of the believers and hypocrites on the day of resurrection, accounts of the past nations, and spending in the way of Allah for establishment of social justice. It criticizes monasticism and social seclusion, and mentions the response received from the public by the previous prophets. We continue from where we left you last Friday, and here is Ayah 21.
سابقوا إلى مغفرة من ربكم وجنة عرضها كعرض السماء والأرض أعدت للذين آمنوا بالله ورسله ذلك فضل الله يؤتيه من يشاء
Take the lead toward forgiveness from your Lord and a paradise as vast as the heavens and the earth, prepared for those who have faith in Allah and His prophets. That is Allah's grace, which He grants to whomever He wishes. And Allah is dispenser of a great grace. If you remember, last week, in our explanation of the previous ayahs of this surah, we said the transient life of the mortal world is not the end, but is a passage towards the hereafter and resurrection for the day of judgment, on which the believers will be rewarded and the disbelievers condemned to eternal punishment. This means it is the proper cognizance of the world and its characteristics that make a person immune from the dangers of disbelief and sins, since excessive attachment to materialistic life is nothing but drifting away from truth and the realities of creation. In other words, life without faith in God and failure to observe spiritual values is just a childish play. It is true that all human beings enjoy the life of the world to varying degrees, including the believers who consider us gifts of God Almighty. But the real bounties are those of the hereafter, where bliss is achieved because of faith and good deeds, while disbelief and sins lead to permanent punishment. The ayah that we recited to you now emphasizes hastening toward divine forgiveness through repentance, self-reform, expiation for missed obligations, obedience to God Almighty, and refraining from sins. Thus, divine forgiveness is actually the key to paradise, whose vastness encompasses the heavens and the earth and is prepared for the believers. Divine forgiveness is necessary before tidings of paradise, because unless a person is absolved of sins, he or she will not be admitted to paradise. A point to note is that paradise, with its numerous bounties, is not obtained through our good deeds, which are indeed insignificant, but it is divine grace, mercy, and favor that multiplies a believer's virtuous acts and makes him or her deserving of the bliss of paradise. This ayah teaches us that, number one, if the life of the world is amusement and pleasures of the flesh for the sinners and disbelievers, it is an excellent opportunity for obeying God's commandments and abstaining from forbidden acts and things for the believers who strive for divine mercy and forgiveness. Number two, the faithless and materialists compete with each other for acquiring wealth and worldly possessions, while the true believers strive for God's grace. And number three, paradise is for the upright believers who have never disobeyed Allah, as well as for those who repent and are forgiven by Allah, whose grace and favors multiply the rewards of our good deeds, which are indeed insignificant. Now let us listen to ayahs 22 and 23 of the same surah.
ما أصاب من مصيبة في الأرض ولا في أنفسكم إلا في كتاب من قبل أن نبرأها إن ذلك على الله يسير لكي لا تأسوا على ما فاتكم ولا تفرحوا بما آتاكم والله لا يحب كل مختال فخور.
No affliction visits the earth or yourselves, but it is in a book before we bring it about. That is indeed easy for Allah, so that you may not grieve for what escapes you, nor exult for what comes your way. And Allah does not like any swaggering braggart. These ayahs mean to say that all things happen as consequences that follow in accordance with the laws made by Allah the All-Wise, whose decrease of occurrences or their postponement and cancellation are pre-recorded in a book from which the announcement has been made to mankind, so that distress could be avoided through good deeds and precautionary measures. This, however, does not mean that the good ones will not suffer disasters or those afflicted with disasters are bad persons. As Ayah 23 means to say, both misfortune and good fortune are divine tests and may turn out to be illusory, since these are designed to test and ascertain the degrees of faith or the lack of it. Therefore, true believers do not envy those who have material possessions. Neither do they exult if they themselves possess worldly assets, nor do they boast and covet. If the true believers are blessed with material bounties, they share them with others as they consider wealth and possession to be gifts of Allah. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, the events and occurrences of the transient life of the mortal world are known to Allah, the All-Wise, and take place at His command. Number two, a faithless person is dejected when misfortune befalls and exults in wild joy when fortune favors him or her, while a true believer is patient in calamities and is thankful to God for whatever they gain. And number three, Allah the All-Merciful, who tests the degrees of faith or the lack of it through both disasters and bounties, at times averts many a calamity, whether accidental or natural, such as storms, earthquakes, epidemics, and the like, because of earnest prayers and supplications to Him. In conclusion of this week's episode, here is Ayah 24 of Surah Hadid.
الَّذِينَ يَبْخَلُونَ وَيَأْمُرُونَ النَّاسَ بِالْبُخْلِ وَمَنْ يَتَوَلَّ فَإِنَّ اللَّهَ هُوَ الْغَنِيُّ الْحَمِيدُ.
Such as are the stingy and beat other people to be stingy, and whoever refuses to comply should know that indeed Allah is the all-sufficient, the all-laudable. This ayah points to the misers and niggardly who not only do not give to the needy from the wealth that God has granted to them, but dissuade others from spending in God's way. In other words, the avaricious and the niggardly not only keep the gifts of Allah from others in society, but also dry up the streams of charity in others. From this ayah we learn that number one, persuading others to be stingy is worse than being stingy. And number two, God has given wealth and possessions as a trial to determine how a rich person behaves, whether he or she helps the needy and spends for a good cause, or keeps on accumulating riches by being stingy and arrogant.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.